Je vous propose de commencer l'exposé ce soir. Nous sommes très heureux d'accueillir pour 4 cours au Collège de France une des grandes personnalités des neurosciences computationnelles, le professeur Xiaojing Wang. We'll switch to English, although Xiaojing understands French, actually. But the presentations will be in French. It is a great pleasure to host you here for a series of 4 weekly conferences dedicated to computational neuroscience of elemental cognition, bridging from computational neuroscience to cognition. Let me just say that Xiaojing got his training with Professor Ilya Prigogine in Brussels, and that's one moment where he learned to speak French, but also learned to model biology and to model complex systems. He moved on to a position in Yale and is now at NYU, and in fact plays a role both at NYU in New York, of course, but also in Shanghai. He helped set up, and he was the director of the campus of NYU Shanghai for 5 years, and continues to help develop the Chinese Brain Project, in particular at the National Academy, the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Shanghai, where there is a wonderful campus and giant projects, we should say, that are extremely interesting with Mooming Poo. But today, of course, he will tell us about his work. And if you look at the bibliography, it's extremely impressive, I should say. Every year, papers in Neuro, Nature Neuroscience, developing this notion of a bridge between what we know about the architecture of the brain, the monkey brain, sometimes also the human brain, and computation, and developing progressively a theory of how the brain computes and how the signals that we measure from the brain are generated. It's a great pleasure to host you tonight. Before we start the lecture, I have a present from Collège de France. It's a tradition for professors who are invited for a month to receive the medal of Collège de France. It has the Collège de France on one side with the date, 1530, and on the other side, Guillaume Budet, and Guillaume, your name on the tranche. So, congratulations.
Thank you so much. Merci beaucoup.
Ce token, alors, appréciation.
Alors, je voudrais commencer par quelques mots en français. Je voudrais remercier Stanislas Dehaene et le Collège de France pour l'invitation. Je suis très heureux d'être ici pour un mois, d'interagir avec des collègues, collaborer avec certains et de partager avec vous les recherches de mon équipe. So, as you know, the brain is big. We do many different things with the brain. Some parts of the brain are about perception, about sensation. Some other parts of the brain are about movement control. That's not what I'm going to talk about. What I'm going to talk about is what's going on in between, between sensation and the movement. That's what, you know, generally speaking, what we call cognition. I will first, you know, start with something rather simple and gradually talk about more complicated cognitive functions, such as how you make choices in daily life next week. And then I'll move on to talk about more complicated distributed cognitive processes in a large-scale, multi-regional brain system. So that's the program for this series of 4 lectures. So today, I will start with something that you probably all know about. It's a function of the brain called working memory. This is just our ability to hold information and manipulate information in our head internally in the absence of external stimulus. You know, this is really a core, a basic function, because imagine that you lost it. You don't have this working memory ability. What that means is that as soon as the stimulus is gone in the environment, you don't have a trace anymore in the brain about that information. So all you can do is to respond right away when the stimulus is still there, which means a reflex, right, a reaction. So working memory allows you to hold the information which is no longer there in the environment so that you can do something about it later on, right? So that because of this, working memory is important for all kinds of cognitive functions and can be justly considered as an atom of cognition. So we'll tell you a bit about the brain structures and the computational models of those structures that are important for working memory. And later on, I'll tell you how this kind of computational principle and the platform can be in fact used to look at the disorders associated with mental illness in a new field called computational psychiatry. So the structures that are considered in this series of lectures are not ones that are fashionable, so to speak. All right, so we are all excited today by incredible advances in machine learning and artificial intelligence. The advances, which are tremendously interesting and important, were initially inspired by what we learned about the visual system in the primates. Okay, the visual system involves certain parts of the brain, indicated here in different color, which do not include other parts of the brain that are more important for higher cognition. In particular, I want to mention this anterior part of the cerebral cortex called the prefrontal cortex, or PFC, which is going to be really important for my discussion. So PFC has long been a mystery. You probably know that about a quarter, half century ago, it was routine for surgeons to treat people suspected to have some mental disorders by frontal lobotomy, so which either destroys part of the prefrontal cortex or cuts the connection between the prefrontal cortex and the rest of the brain. In fact, one of the JFK siblings, Rosemary Kennedy, went through this frontal lobotomy when she was very young, unfortunately. Just illustrating, at that time, we really didn't know what that part of the brain is good for. Only recently, the rigorous scientific research about prefrontal function has taken off. So if you use the keyword prefrontal cortex to search medical literature, you'll find that the publications really took off starting in the mid-90s. Today, we have more than 50 papers published with this keyword every day. So now we know that prefrontal cortex is important for many kinds of cognitive functions, ranging from working memory, which is the topic of today's lecture, to decision-making, which is the topic of next week's lecture, to other things like language, consciousness, multitasking, how we can control impulsive responses, et cetera, selective attention. In spite of this wide range of cognitive functions of very different degrees of complexity, we now have some really knowledge about how that system works. For example, in the laboratory, you can train animals, non-human animals, like mice or monkey, to perform a delayed response task. So in this case, you show briefly a stimulus, followed by a delay period, during which time you have to remember what it was, right, for just a few seconds. At the end of the delay, you're required to generate a memory-guided response. So you separate temporally sensation and movement in order to study what's going on internally during the delay period. That depends on working memory. Lesion studies show that prefrontal cortex is important for this kind of tasks. In the early 70s, Joaquin Fuster started to record from single neurons from behaving monkeys in a delayed response task, and they found this really amazing memory cells. What's shown here are the three individual behavior trials in the delay task. Is the tick marks are the spikes or action potentials of a single neuron recorded from behavior monkey. You see that this particular cell is not really active until the stimulus is presented, but it keeps being active throughout a delay of 20 or 30 seconds when the animal has to remember what it was, right? In the fourth and fifth trial, you ask the animal to remember for a much longer time, and then the activity will just keep going as long as you need that information internally. And when you don't need that information anymore, the activity is gone, right? So this activity is called persistent activity. That's internally sustained, not driven by external stimulus. It's important to also mention that this kind of persistent activity may not just be for sensory information storage, but it can be for thinking. Can be for many other internal mental processes. For example, in another monkey experiment by Oral Miller, the monkey is trained to perform a task that depends on behavioral rule. So you do this if rule is number one, and you do that if rule is number two. In that experiment, they found that the single neurons in the prefrontal cortex show this delay activity that now holds in mind a behavioral rule rather than a sensory stimulus. All right. So very intriguing, biological question, scientific question is how this kind of internal information containing information produced and maintained. That's basically the question that drives research in my lab for many years. So we just simply asked, so what are the circuit properties that exist in the prefrontal cortex, for example, in contrast to, say, primary visual cortex that enable such a circuit to subserve cognitive functions as in contrast to early sensory encoding? The theoretical idea is attract networks in mathematics, promoted by John Hopfield, Daniel Amit, and others. So the idea is that such a circuit has multiple stable states, illustrated here in a two-dimensional activity space. So each field circle is a attractor in the sense that if the system starts out being nearby, over time it will evolve towards that attractor state, as if you are near the bottom of a valley, of a mountain range, so if you are nearby, you are just converging to the bottom, right? But the key is that you have multiple attractor states. One of them might be resting state, the other one would represent different memory items. If that's the case, then you can imagine that a transient input can switch the system from one state to another, right? So that's the idea. And you can stay there because it's an attractor state, even when the input is gone. So how is that done biologically in the brain? Well, one puzzle is coming from the fact that single neurons are forgetful. They have very short time constants, on the order of 10 milliseconds, which means that when an input is gone, the response would decay away within tens of milliseconds. Milliseconds, right? So how can I think about a neuron circuit that can sustain information for much, much longer when the input is not there anymore, for milliseconds? An idea in answer to this question, one, all the way back to Lorenzo Donnell in the 1930s, called reverberation. So the idea of reverberation is that if you have a group of neurons that are not isolated from each other, but they talk to each other through recurrent excitation, then when they are excited by a transient input, they fire spikes, right? And then they talk to each other more. So if the strength of recurrent excitation, if the communication is powerful enough, then you can imagine that they can just keep going even when the input is gone. Right, so this reverberation idea received some report anatomically, indeed in layer 2-3 of the macaque monkey prefrontal cortex. Godmarkish observed this kind of structure. So we decided to test this idea using quantitative mathematical model. We used what we call biophysically based neuron circuit modeling. By that, we simply mean that a model is not just abstract mathematical model, but it's a really quantitatively calibrated, controlled, or constrained by two foundations of neurobiology. One of them is neural anatomy. Basically, these days, it's called connectomics. So it's about the wiring diagram, about different cell types, etc. On the other hand, neurophysiology, the dynamics, right? Electrical activity, and maybe some other biophysical processes related to the neural activity. In order to be really concrete, let me tell you, a model that was designed to look at the particularly elegant working memory task by Godmarkish. So in this case, the information you need to remember is just the location of a visual cue, indicated here with a red square. So at the end of the delay, the fixation point goes away. There's nothing on the screen. Now you have to make a very fast eye movement to the location where the cue was flashed. The eye position is monitored, so you can quantitatively measure how precise is the response. That's based on the memory of where it was across the delay period. So during this spatial working memory task or oculomotor delay response task, people found that in prefrontal cortex and posterior parietal cortex, which is about over here, neurons show this elevated delay activity. And if from trial to trial, you show a cue at different location, say at one of the eight cues with a fixed eccentricity. So the information you need to remember across the delay is a directional angle. Then you will find that each of the cells would show this tuning of delayed activity, with a preferred direction, right? So you should imagine that different neurons have different preferred direction or location, and across the whole population, you'll have a memory map, right? So you can remember any location on the screen. So let's say we try to build a model to understand how this really happens. And so you would have a now what we call a continuous recurrent network pioneered by people like Banishe, Samolinsky, and ours. You have, in this case, two types of neurons, excitatory pyramidal cells on one hand and inhibitory GABAergic cells on the other hand. Pyramidal cells are labeled by the preferred direction from 0 to 360 degrees as an analog quantity, a directional angle. And the recurrent excitation depends on the difference of the preferred cues of any two cells. So when the two cells have similar preferred directions, they are strongly connected, whereas the cells are far apart, they are less exciting to each other, right? And that inhibition is important for selectivity generation. There's a parameter in the model called, let's call that GE, which measures how strong is recurrent excitation, E to E connection, right? So let's test the idea that in the model, if we just change this parameter GE from small to big, at some point I'm going to see self-sustained persistent activity suitable for working memory representation. And the answer is yes. Here's a model simulation now where I show many neurons in the network labeled by preferred direction along the y-axis over time, right? Each tick mark is a spike. You see that the network initially is in a resting state where neurons are uniformly active at a low rate. During this brief Q period, you provide a transient input, in this case at the center of the network at 180 degrees, which activate more spikes in this group of neurons. They start to reverberate, right, through recurrent excitation. And that's why when the input is gone during the delay period in yellow, the activity keeps going. So you can quantify the pattern of activity by just plotting the firing rate of each neuron across the population on the right. And that way, at the end of the delay, you can retrieve the memory by looking at the peak location of this bell-shaped, what we call Bomba tract, right? So you can imagine that next time, if you show a stimulus somewhere else, you would generate the same kind of Bomba tract, but peaked at a different location, right? So there's a whole family of Bomba tracts, each one encoding a particular direction. Does that make sense? So that happens when the parameter GEE, the strength of recurrent excitation, is large enough. Another thing that's important to mention is the precision of working memory representation, which is quantified by the width of the bomb attractor, right? So the narrower is the bomb, the more precise is the encoded information. The broader is the bomb, the less precise is the information represented by the population. That will become important for us. So this particular simulation corresponds to the parameter of GEE over here in orange, where I show all the internally sustained attractor states with a given GEE value, right? And so you see that there's a coexistence of the resting state at low rate and the family of bomb attractors so that you can switch back and forth between the states with a transient input. Interestingly, and that's a very important concept I want to convey, if you change GEE in a modest range, there's a threshold level. Below the threshold, there's no persistent activity. All you have is spontaneous activity state, but by a great change of parameter, you can have the emergence of a totally different phenomena, namely persistent activity attractor states. This phenomena mathematically is called bifurcation, and that's quite powerful, I think, when we deal with nonlinear dynamical systems, which are recurrent neural circuits. So this provides a way for us to understand, for example, why early sensory areas like V1 or MT don't show delay activity in working memory, maybe because GEE parameter value in those systems are below the threshold, whereas the value of GEE in PPC or PFC is above the threshold. All right. So recurrent excitation is important. Now, it has to be balanced by inhibition, right? A few years, actually quite some years ago in 2004, we expanded the model I just described to you to include three kinds of interneurons. You know, one puzzle about the cerebral cortex is the diversity of inhibited neurons, which Cahal called the butterfly of the soul. So we look at the three kinds of interneurons back then. We motivated by the need for working memory system to be able to get out distractors, right? So when you try to hold something in your mind, what is hard is not just remember what you're supposed to remember. What's hard is that you're also supposed to ignore the distractors that are behaviorally irrelevant, right? You see some people are a lot more easily distractible than others, right? So we thought that in order to study that, we actually should look a bit more into biology and look at the different kinds of interneurons. So in this model, the first type of neuron, interneurons are in black. They control the spiking output of pyramidal cells. The second type of interneurons that have different biomarkers that may express somatostatin or carbendin, those are the blue cells. They target dendrites of pyramidal cells where the inputs come in. So they are in good position to gate the inputs onto pyramidal cells. And the third type of interneurons are in green. They may be labeled by VIP or carotenin. They target the green cells, right? So the idea is that the blue cells are usually very active with high baseline. So that get out basically all the information. Now, when you need to get in information, what happens is that you somehow activate the green cells, which suppresses the blue cells, thereby opening the gate for the corresponding population of pyramidal cells. Does that make sense? This scheme actually recently has gained a lot of experimental support using cell type specific genetic tools like optogenetics. Now, you know, this so-called disinhibited motif is well established. So a prediction of this model then is that the pyramidal cells would show this bell-shaped tuning of memory activity, whereas you should see another population corresponding to the blue cells that show inverted tuning, right? For some stimulus, the activity should be lower relative to baseline, right? So that's the, what the model predicts, and this is the model result. This is pyramidal cells. This is an example of dendrite targeting the neurons. The baseline is this, and you see that for some cues, the activity is reduced, right, relative to the baseline. And we analyzed single units from behaving monkey. Indeed, we found some neurons that show exactly that, right? So this is one example of a recording neuron from behaving monkey that shows reduced activity for some cues relative to the baseline, which is very high. Suggesting that this model is probably correct. We also simulated actually distractors directly in this model. What you see here is an example where you first show a cue that you're supposed to remember. So you get this delay activity, and the activity level is indicated by color. Then during the delay period, you show a distractor. Right? In this case, you see that the network is distracted, right? So the person activity here is gone, and instead you have the information only about the distractor. Whereas in the second panel, you see the opposite. You see a transient response to the distractor, but the information about the initial cue is preserved. The person activity, this bound by attractor, remains the same. So whether a network is able to filter out the distractor or not depends on several factors, including the inhibitory circuitry or the integrity of inhibitory circuit. So if in our model, we adjust the relative contributions of inhibition from the dendrite targeting carbendin / somatostatin interneurons versus somatic inhibition mediated by PV neurons, we found that dendritic inhibition is a lot better at filtering out the distractors, as you would expect. Let me also tell you something that's absolutely essential for working memory function using this kind of model. That is, it is very hard for you to hold many things at the same time in your mind at a given moment. So that's under the name of memory capacity, right? So that can be studied in multiple ways. And that has generated recently actually a debate in computational neuroscience, which I'm going to explain to you now. So for example, instead of trying to remember one thing, you're trying to remember multiple things. In this behavioral paradigm, you show a number of items, colored squares. After a delay period, something changed in one of the items, in, such as the color or the position. Your task is to detect the change based on the short-term memory of the initial array of items. Using this item, it was found that the accuracy of performance is very high as long as the number of items, set size, is below 3. When you have more than 3 items, the performance starts to go down. Using a model that's called a slot model, you can estimate how many items are stored in your working memory system, which assumes that the working memory system has a number of discrete slots. So each item is stored in one slot. If you have only n slots, then you are in trouble when you present. You're supposed to remember n plus 1 or more than n items. And by doing this model fitting, it was concluded that the memory capacity for visual working memory is very small, on the order of 3 to 4 items. On the other hand, in a slightly different paradigm, you show again an array of discrete items, but this time the response requirement is different. So you ask at the end of the delay, you point to one of the items and ask, what's the color of that item? By pointing to a position of a color ring. So the response is parametric. It's a quantitative estimation of what was the color that you remember across the delay period. Right? So in that case, what you can do is to measure the error quantitatively, right? The distance between the correct answer and your estimate, right, along the x-axis, and you will find that with a small number of items, the performance can be very high, so accuracy is very high with zero error, and you have a distribution of errors like this in blue. Whereas when the number of items is big, in this case, in red, when the size size is 6, the peak goes down and the distribution is broader, right? So the variance was found to be linear with the number of items. So you don't see really a step jump in the variance, suggesting that instead of a slot model, maybe the working memory system should be thought of as a limited resource. You have to divide this continuum resource in whatever way you need in order to deal with whatever number of items that you have to remember in your mind. Okay? So there's this big fight between the two camps about slot versus continuous resource. So we used our model to address this issue just by presenting more than one stimulus and see what happens. Remember that our model is a continuous network model. So in principle, it starts out as a continuous resource model, right? And so this is a simulation where I show 2 stimuli here and here, which generates 2 bumps instead of 1. So at the end of the delay, you can retrieve the information about each of the 2 very accurately, right? Now let's do another simulation where you show 5 items to the same network. Do you see 5 independent bumps? Start, yes, initially yes, but not really throughout the whole delay period of 1 second. Instead, you see 2 interesting dynamical phenomena. For example, 1 bump can just disappear, so you would lose that information, right? Or 2 nearby bumps interact with each other and merge into a bigger one, right? So this imply that at the end of the day, you only have a limited number of bump states that are stable, right? We show that this model can explain most of the behavioral observations, including the performance that is high when the number of items is below 3 and then goes down, and the standard deviation or the variance of the readout goes linearly with the number of items, right? So in a way, this model actually provides a biologically plausible reconciliation of those 2 models, right? You start out with a continuous resource, yet the items actually are remembered with discrete bumps. Furthermore, this suggests some dynamical mechanism why you have limited working memory capacity, because of those 2 phenomena, the disappearance or the merging of neural populations that encode the different items. Now, let me move on to talk about another debate in today's literature, namely, exactly what's the dynamical nature of working memory representation? Is it really like steady state persistent activity or something a lot more dynamical, Let me start by saying that it's important just to reiterate that attractor states don't have to be steady state, right? So I already I'm showing here an example of delayed activity. Again, this is network, this is time. If you zoom in, actually you don't see sustained activity. Instead, you see population activity indicated by color that is synchronized and comes and goes, right? So a population measure or the local field potential measure would show this very powerful peak in the power spectrum in the range of 40 hertz, the famous gamma oscillation. This is because the network is strongly recurrent. You have this interplay between fast excitation mediated by the so-called AMPA receptors that interacts with slower inhibition mediated by GABA-A receptors. As you all know from physics and engineering, when you have a strongly recurrent network with very strong, fast, positive feedback, interplay with slow and negative feedback, very easily you get oscillations. This oscillation has been observed in animals and non-human and human subjects associated with cognition. So it's very interesting. In particular, people found very commonly that when you are paying attention to something, sensory systems show enhanced gamma oscillations. We have examined how that might happen in the loop model now, where we assume that attention signal is originating and sustained in the working memory system, and that biases information processing in a sensory system. And of course, as you would expect, because the system generates gamma oscillations, when you engage selective attention this way, you will see enhanced coherence in the gamma range, as observed in monkey experiment. And the model also explained another aspect of selective attention, namely selective enhancement of neuron activity in the sensory system. However, this provides a segue to say that too much oscillations may be a problem, as shown here. What I show here are three different simulations. What I change is the relative contribution to the recurrent excitation by two types of receptors, the fast AMPA receptor and the slower NMDA receptor with a time constant of 50 to 100 milliseconds. So NMDA receptors are really important, you probably know. Actually it was discovered here at the Ecole Normale that NMDA receptors are important for learning and memory. Right. So what you see here over here is that if the reverberation at the recurrent synapses have a lot of NMDA receptors, you get a very nice presence activity during the delay period. But now if you reduce that contribution and enhance the contribution by the AMPA receptors, you see more fluctuations. Over here, you have even more AMPA contribution. What do you see? Well, you see that delay activity is not sustained. Right? Eventually, it collapses back to resting state in the middle of the delay. In that scenario, the memory trace is lost. Right? That's because gamma oscillation generates this big amplitude oscillations, which may lead to dynamical instability. So the model predicts back in 1990 that recurrent excitation has to be slow and dependent on NMDA receptors. And that prediction has been tested in a monkey experiment using exactly the same spatial working memory task. So here you see, again, the same selective persistence activity for preferred direction, but not for non-preferred direction in blue. Now in some trials, the experimentalists use the electrode to inject a very small dosage of drug using a technique called iontophoresis that blocks NMDA receptors in very small number of cells, including the one you record from that same electrode. In support of the model, it was found that when you do that, when you block NMDA receptors in the recorded neuron in red, essentially the delay activity is gone, suggesting that indeed NMDA receptors are important for working memory. So this illustrates how a biophysically based model, is able to provide perhaps some insights across levels, from behavior to recurrent circuit dynamics in the form of attractor dynamics and down to receptors. Computationally, this actually is very interesting. It led us to have a very different perspective about working memory. So instead of thinking working memory as a switch system, right, back and forth between states, we can think about working memory in the form of integration. So if you still remember, what is the integral of a post-tile input? Well, it's this, right? So the persistent activity can be thought of as just temporal integral of this transient input in time. And that idea will be exploited next week, because that means that if you need to take time to make a choice among different options in decision making, you would want to have a mechanism in the brain to accumulate information about different options in the form of this quasi-linear ramping activity, right? And that will show can be done exactly by this slow reverberation mechanism. So that's for next week. So this already shows you something that's not just the steady state, but the transient dynamics, right? And again, attractor states don't have to be steady state. They can be time varied. Another example is coming from a well-known paper from Misha Sodik's group showing this synchronized repetition of activity in very brief spike packages that repeat in a rhythmic fashion. That's another example of time-varying persistent activity. Just go to the extreme to push the point clear and loud. Even very complicated fluid turbulence with eddies, vortices on all scales actually are described mathematically as high-dimensional attractor states of the Navier-Stokes equation. So the fact that you see complicated dynamics don't necessarily mean it's not necessarily an argument against the attractor model. On the other hand, of course, there are alternatives, right? So for example, is it possible that you can have memory trace without spikes? So some activity will just decay away. Instead, you have some internal states, say by short-term facilitation, that can help you to remember what it was. And that was proposed by Michel Sodix. Another possibility is a temporal sequence, so in which you have neurons that take turns to be active only briefly, right? So this is shown from David Tang's group in the delay task. Neurons in the posterior parietal cortex of mice show this sequential activation. It's really a very interesting phenomena, and people put a lot of efforts trying to understand this. It makes a lot of sense if the information you are dealing with change over time, right? But if the information you want to remember is a fixed thing, is one thing, it's a bit puzzling how you can read out that information at different time points if the coding is a temporal sequence, because at different time points, you would have to look at different neural populations which have that information at a different time, right? So that's a open question. Now, let me ask a slightly different question. Is it possible that in spite of temporal dynamics, you could still have stable neural representation for working memory? To study that, people use the so-called decoding method that Stanislas actually talked about this morning in his lecture. So what you do is to start with some neural data, in his case, MEG data. This is a well-known paper from Mark Stokes and colleagues using single-unit data and maybe multi-unit data. What you do is to train an artificial classifier to decode the content stored in those neurons, right, at some time point. For example, you can train your decoder at during stimulus precipitation at 150 milliseconds. And then you use that decoder to see if you can still read out the information later on. And in this case, the answer is, well, if you are near the 250 millisecond time point, yes, in red. But if you are into the delay period, no. You see that the decoding is very low, right? Suggesting that somehow the decoder has to change over time. And that leads to the idea that either decoding has to change over time, or against some kind of activity silent state that does not depend on persistent activity. But I have to say, at least this study is not so persuasive, because their own data don't really show that. So if you train the classifier at any point during the delay period, you can use that same classifier to decode information anytime during the delay. We re-examined this question using data from this spatial working memory task and another task that's well known from Romo's lab. In the second experiment, this is called the vibrotactile delayed discrimination task, VDD. You show first the stimulus like this at one frequency F1, followed by a delay period. And then you show a second stimulus at a frequency F2. Your task is to decide whether F2 is larger or smaller than F1. Romo found that single neurons in prefrontal cortex show this delay activity that's parametrically changing with the initial stimulus F1. So if you look at single cells from those two monkey experiments, indeed there's a huge heterogeneity, right? So I show six different neurons from one experiment, six different neurons from another experiment. They're all over the places. Also, each one does show temporal variations in a very different way. What does that mean? What's this dynamical evolution good for? We don't really understand. But we carried out a novel method, analysis called population state space analysis. So imagine that you record from 100 neurons. Given a condition, each firing rate from one neuron is a number, right? So let's plot 100 numbers in 100 dimensional space. Right, so firing rate 1 corresponds to axis, x-axis, firing rate 2 corresponds to y-axis, etc. Right, so the state would correspond to one point in the high-dimensional, 100-dimensional state space. Then the delay activity corresponds to a trajectory in that space. So we analyzed, using principal component analysis, subspaces in that high-dimensional space. To our surprise, in spite of heterogeneity and temporal dynamics, there is a subspace in each of the two cases with low dimension in which the working memory representation is very stable across the delay period. So most of the temporal changes happen in the orthogonal subspace, suggesting that, in fact, temporal dynamics, whatever functionally roles they are, can be consistent with a stable neural representation for working memory. More recently, we further pushed this topic by a very different approach. This is so-called training recurrent network approach that borrows ideas from machine learning, artificial intelligence. In this case, you start out with a very boring, trivial network which doesn't do anything, right? And the connections between units in here either don't exist or are random. Then you train the network and kind of supervise and force the network to do a task. So using what's called backpropagation, actually a version of that algorithm called stochastic gradient descent, the weights of connections will gradually change from trial to trial. Over many trials, the network learns to perform the task, right? So when the network learns to perform the task, now you can open the box and see, oh, what happens? Do you have delay activity or not? Why the network can do it, what strategy the network uses. So in this particular experiment, or model simulation, we assume that the recurrent synapses have short-term plasticity. The idea we test is maybe short-term plasticity can be an alternative to persistent activity for working memory representation. So perhaps the network learns to perform a delay task without delay activity, right? And we'll see what happens. Well, we learned two lessons from this exercise. Number one, that's shown here. Basically, this is how good you can read out the information when you have different delay duration in different simulations with different networks. So if you train your network to do a task with a delay that's relatively short compared to the short-term facilitation time constant, indeed, in some networks, the decoding is basically chance level. So those are the examples where the network can perform the task using internal variables, synaptic facilitation variable, but not persistent activity. So this would be examples of activity silent state model, right? However, if the delay is very long compared to the biophysical time constants, in this case, 1.5 second, then through training, the persistent activity just emerges. So you can read out the information through sustained activity. So that's lesson number one. Lesson number two, we asked, what happens if we train the network to do a task that has to manipulate the information? So in this case, it's a so-called delayed task, and the network has to do one of the two tasks based on a rule signal. So you show a directional stimulus followed by a delay period, and if you show rule one, you're supposed to do a delayed match to sample. That is to decide whether a second stimulus has exactly the same direction as the first stimulus. So this is a delayed match to sample. It's like you're looking for a friend and your mental image of your friend has to match with what you see, right? But if rule is number two, you have to do something very different, well, slightly different. So now the question is, if you rotate the initial cue by 90 degrees, does it match with test? So that requires not only maintenance of information, but also manipulation of information by rotating the initial sample by 90 degrees. So when you train the network to do this task, very interesting, even the delay is very short, actually, inevitably, you get the generation of persistent activity. So what that means is that manipulation of information, which is a big part of working memory, requires spikes. You cannot really do that with spikes. Finally, we asked the question to address another argument of activity silent state. So the argument is that, well, spikes are costly, right? They, you know, cost energy. If you can get away with it, maybe you should use the activity silent state instead of persistent activity. So in order to look at that, we asked from each recorded neuron, so this is data analysis again from monkey experiments, and we plotted the distribution of firing rates across recorded neurons before the stimulus presentation, during the cue period, and during the delay period. To our big surprise, in both monkey experiments, the distribution is virtually the same in the two in or three behavioral epochs. So basically, what this says is that, in fact, it doesn't cause more spikes during the delay period than even in the resting state. Because in the delay period, some neurons go up, but other neurons go down, and the totality of spikes in that population remains the same through some mechanism that we don't know. All right. So I think the argument about the cost of spikes is not really persuasive. So let me just reiterate the two points related to this debate. One is that perhaps we should distinguish active working memory from short-term memory, which may be passive. So for example, if I ask you, what did you have at breakfast? You would remember what you had, right, at breakfast. So that's a short-term memory. You will not remember, you know, a month from now. But that's not done through persistent activity that started this morning until now, right? Okay, so passive short-term memory happens on all timescales, and that should be different from active working memory. And again, manipulation is a big part of working memory, which probably explains why persistent activity is so important to understand working memory. So let me spend the next 10 minutes or so to tell you a bit about how we and others used this kind of computational models to examine what might go wrong in mental illness, right? The idea is that prefrontal cortex and other related brain structures are really the same structures that are abnormal in mental disorders like schizophrenia, autism, bipolar disorder, depression, you name it. So we and others like Carl Friston, Peter Diane, Reed Montague, thought that maybe we can use this kind of models, again, in collaboration with neuron experimentalists, even clinicians, to look at potential causes, biological explanations of mental disorders. In the interest of time, I'm just going to give you a few examples illustrating this very interesting new field, bridging to clinical applications. In fact, it's been a long time that people know that NMDA signaling is lower And this hypofunction of NMDA receptors is a major pathology of schizophrenia. But for a long time, people studied this in the context of long-term memory and learning, right? Because NMDA receptors are important for learning and memory. And we just, I just talked to you about another role of NMDA receptors, namely it's important for active cognition, which I, again, we'll talk about next week when we talk about decision making. So, and that new perspective is in line with clinical work, especially by John Christo at Yale. What he found some years ago is that a low dose of ketamine, which blocks NMDA receptors, can induce in healthy subjects like you and me some deficits that resemble schizophrenia, right? And that doesn't depend on long-term memory or plasticity, right? So maybe our work sheds some insight on why that happens. So we use the same model, asked what happens if we reduce NMDA receptors at different pathway to the model, to working memory function. There are two potential sites. Why is this recurrent excitation, GEE? That depends on NMDA receptors. The other one is actually NMDA receptors in interneurons, right? So what happens if you reduce that pathway? So you would have less drive to interneurons. So that's what's shown here. This is a bump attractor during the delay period. This is the network of the model. Compare the control in blue. When you reduce inhibition, the bump broadens in orange. So what that implies is that the precision of working memory representation is reduced in this situation, right? So the prediction is that now, if you introduce a distractor that's nearby, you would be confused with the fat bump, right? So maybe then you will perform not very good in that situation, not very well. And that's indeed shown in our model first, that the error rate is higher with a distractor nearby, but not when it is far away from the initial cue. And then we carried out, in collaboration with John Christo, with human subjects, with the low dosage of ketamine. And he found exactly that, that in human with low dosage of ketamine, the error rate is higher with a distractor nearby, but not far away. We systematically analyzed in the model kind of impaired working memory by reducing this drive to eye cells along the y-axis or by reducing recurrent excitation along the y-axis. So as I already explained, if you go this way, the bump gets wider and you're more distractible, right? So in fact, say schizophrenic patients are not really incapable of working memory. They can hold something in their mind. What is difficult for them is to resist the distractors. So this may explain why that happens. On the other hand, if the recurrent excitation gets weaker and weaker, you go this way, and then you will fall into a regime where you don't have recurrent excitation anymore. And I mean, it's not strong enough, so the delay activity is gone completely. Right? So there are two kinds of symptoms that the model predicts. Finally, we asked, is there a way to use this model to probe how you can kind of recover normal function, right? Suppose you start out with increased bump width. What can you do in the model to recover the original precision of working memory representation? So we found that either you enhance the GABA release onto pyramidal cells in the model in green, or you reduce the glutamate release in purple, you can recover the original control precision of working memory. Suggesting, one example at least, how you might think about, looking at circuit-based, intervention for this kind of deficits. Now, can we, move a little bit beyond working memory and think about executive functions in general? So let me give you one more example before I stop. Working memory is one basic function of prefrontal cortex, but PFC is sometimes called the CEO of the brain. It's important for executive functions in general. And one of the executive functions is inhibitory control. So when you have this impulsivity, you have this impulse to generate some response, which is automatic, habitual, prepotent, but you're not supposed to do it, right? There's a mechanism to hold your horse in the brain. That depends on prefrontal cortex, right? And that people think may be related to the wiring of prefrontal cortex. So we thought maybe we could use similar kind of model to study executive control. There's a very simple paradigm that people use to study inhibitor control. In this experiment, you are normally just circade to a target when it is shown suddenly. Okay, so you are fixating at the center. When a target is shown, you just move your eyes to that target, and you are done. This is a GO trials. But in some trials, unpredictably, soon after the target, you show a stop signal, either by a sound or by a visual cue, saying, don't do it. In that case, you're supposed to suppress your planned reaction. Of course, that depends on the time lag between the target and the onset of a stop signal, how good you are at suppressing response with a stop signal kind of probes how good you are with inhibitory control. So we developed a model just like what I talked to you, except that now we add a third population, another population in blue, which represents stop process or fixation process that interacts with action selection neuron pools in green through inhibition. And the model reproduced the behavior first, right, as shown here. If you increase the delay, so-called stop signal delay, between the onset of the target and the onset of the stop signal, you're more likely to still generate a response because the delay is too long. You're not able to suppress or cancel the planned action, right? But for fixed SSD, stop signal delay, the actions are also stochastic. So you see this distribution of reaction times when you don't have stop signal in black. And then when you do have a stop signal with a fixed SSD, you get sometimes still a response, sometimes you don't, all right? So if you plot the distribution of reaction times in those trials where you actually do see a generation of a response, you get this green curve, right? So the cumulative distribution is actually the same in the two cases until at this time point, the two curves diverge. What that suggests, as proposed by Good and Logan, is that there's a race between GO process and the stop process. And the stop process takes some time. That is defined by this, this time window called the stop signal reaction time, SSRT. So if the GO response is slower than this time, then you're able to suppress it. If it's quicker than the stop process, then you're not able to cancel it. Does that make sense? It's a very simple, but a very quantitative measure. So SSRT can be measured, in clinical setting, and it was found that people who are more impulsive would have a longer SSRT. So it's more difficult for those people to hold their horse, so to speak, all right? So it's a very good measure for this inhibitor control function. And the model, just by passing in the interest of time, reproduces the single neuron physiology as shown here, comparing the model with the single unit data in monkey. The model also suggests that, in fact, interestingly, using this attractor perspective, that in a single trial, whether you're able to suppress a planned action or not when there is a stop signal, really is determined by the internal state before the stop signal even happens, as shown here. So what that means is that what really is more effective is proactive enhancement of control signal by prefrontal cortex even before the stop signal shows up than reactive response when there is a stop signal. More recently, we expanded our model to a large-scale brain circuit system, and that was in part inspired by the observation that not just cortex, but some subcortical structures are important for inhibitory control. In particular, certain parts of the basal ganglia, like the subthalamic nucleus, mediating what's called a hyperdirect pathway, is really crucial for holding your horse when you need to stop some prepotent response. So we expanded our biophysically based model, which now includes the cortex, different pathways of basal ganglia, as well as thalamus, right? So in this larger scale system, it's interesting in many different ways because, for one, maybe it can generate different type of functions, like working memory and inhibitory control. And secondly, you have different kinds of loops. You can have loops, recurrent excitation within the cortex. You can have the thalamocortical loop. You can also have the cortical basal ganglia thalamocortical loop, right? And so, for example, we can look at the possibility that working memory depends on bigger loops rather than just local cortical circuitry. This is shown here. You have the strength of intracortical local excitation. You have the strength of thalamocortical pathway. So the whether you do or you don't have persistent activity, blue versus green, depends on the combination of the two, right? So if you are below this curve, you are not able to sustain activity when the input is gone. But if you are above that curve, in green, you are able to generate self-sustained persistent activity. So this is an example where persistent activity depends on the big loop. Now we can simulate using the same model the stop signal task and extract SSRT as a measure of the strength of inhibitory control. Very surprisingly, we found that if you gradually change G parameter here with fixed W, so you go from here to here, you are going to cross this bifurcation, right? And it turns out that SSRT shows this step decrease across the bifurcation point, right? So when you don't have persistent activity, SSRT is this high, but when you do have persistent activity, SSRT is smaller, meaning that inhibitory control is more powerful, more effective, right? Suggesting a relationship between working memory and inhibitory control. Finally, and this is my last slide, we asked, in this complicated circuit, what happens if we change the strength of a particular pathway to the SSRT, to the inhibitory control function? The answer is very complex. So if you change the strength of cortical input or change the strength of cortical thalamic input, there's no change to SSRT. But if you change the strength of some other pathways, SSRT either goes up or goes down. I would like to leave to you with this picture, showing that, you know, yes, circuit approach is interesting, is important, but the system is really complex. We don't really know yet whether we're going to find the very simple general principles. Not yet, but I think it's still a very exciting beginning. To really start with basic research, focus on circuits, and then look at what happens to cognitive functions. Let me end by thanking people who did the work or contributed to the work that I talked to you about today and the work I'm going to talk to you in the next 3 weeks. Students and postdocs on the left and the collaborators on the right. And thank you for your attention.